and frightened and trying not to show it. Hear the voices shouting and I only feel confused. It's hard to tell what truth is and where you should be going. You look around for guidance and wind up feeling used.
Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Stephanie and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Please don't get up and down during the meeting to minimize distractions while the speaker is sharing. Now I'm going to introduce the speaker, Brooksy. So everybody please welcome her.
Hey everybody, I'm Brooksy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Grateful to be here, grateful to be sober, grateful for everything I once took for granted. My sobriety date's October 4th, 1987, and through the grace of these rooms and my higher power, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink today, and for that I'm truly grateful. So, I haven't told my story in a while, so this is kind of exciting. And I wore a Halloween shirt just because it's Halloween. I thought it was appropriate for me. Okay, anyway. So I'm old school AA. I came in, first of all, I was born here in Atlanta, but I didn't grow up here. My father was in the Air Force. He was a lawyer in the Air Force, and we traveled around the world. We were over in Africa when I was a little girl, and then we ended up in the Washington, D.C. area. And then we moved up to Boston, and my father was a civil rights activist. He actually worked for Dr. King, and we had this very colorful, very bohemian youth. And I started getting high when I was 12. I had an older sister, and we had a theater company on the property, and I started smoking pot when I was 12 years old. That was in the 60s, you know, when it was like back in the olden days. And it wasn't as strong as it is now, apparently. So, and I wasn't much of a drinker. I did drink, but I was a cheap drunk, not an expensive drunk. So some of you women can relate to this. I don't know. The men, I don't really know how to talk to them. So if y'all can just kind of listen in, like pretend it's a women's meeting. But if you know what I mean. Okay. So anyway, the whole thing about it was that I was a cheap drunk, not an expensive drunk. Just a little bit would mess me up. It didn't take a lot. I mean, I took drugs when I was young also as part of my story in college and all that sort of stuff. And I'd take a half a Quaalude and they'd be checking my breathing to see if I was still alive. You know, that kind of thing. So I'm a musician. I got signed when I was 19 in New York by, of all people, Bobby Darin. And I was a songwriter and all this. And I thought I was very cool and very groovy. And, you know, we did a lot of drugs. But we, you know, we drank, we partied. It was that kind of a scene. It was New York City. I was in Manhattan. It was getting worse. And a lot of it was, was my stomach. My stomach would get real messed up. And I would end up, like, going to the hospital, and they would give you something good, you know, and you could take it home and you'd feel better. Y'all know what that's like, you know, to feel better, because I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. And it was getting harder and harder, and I had had a first husband. In New York, we call them a starter spouse. I had one of those, and, yeah, and that kind of ended because I ran off with the bass player in my band, like you do, and you ladies know what I'm talking about. So anyway, because that's what life was like. It was chaotic, it was crazy, and it was a lot of fun, but it was also getting worse, and it was getting worse quickly. So, and as a matter of fact, when I was 21 years old, I gave up hard liquor and drugs because I knew they were going to kill me. I was 21 years old. But guess what? Wine counts. I did not know that. This is the olden days. I didn't know what AA was. I'd never heard of it. This is 1985, 84, earlier in the 70s. I'd never heard of AA. I knew nothing about all that. All I knew that a drunk was my uncle, Bernard, who would be under, you know, in the raincoat under the bridge. That's what I thought an alcoholic was. I didn't think women could be alcoholics. I just didn't know. You know, I never heard of it. And I also thought I was safe because I had given up drugs and I had to withdraw from them. I didn't know what withdrawal was. So I was home for the summer in college and I was feeling real bad. That was withdrawal. I didn't even know what it was, but that's what happened. So anyway, I got where I was just getting crazier and crazier in Manhattan. And finally, I was 29 years old, and I called my parents and said, can you come and get me? They lived in Virginia. And they said, Daddy said, can you get home on your own? I went, no. So they actually came and got me. I was 29 years old, and I came back to my parents' house kind of in a basket and, you know, joined another band because I'm a musician. I joined a band and ended up meeting my second husband, the father of my children. And I just, and he was, of course, 10 years younger than me because I'm me. And he was the drummer in a band, and we were, you know, together. And he said, you know, you're weird when you drink. He goes, because the drinking, I was drinking wine, and, you know, and I would, music saved my life. I'm going to tell you guys this. Art will save you, because I wouldn't drink when I was playing until the last set, which is why I no longer do fourth sets, because that was when they would bring up these big schooners of wine. Because when you're a girl, and you're pretty, and you're the lead singer in a band, you don't have to pay for anything. I mean, I didn't pay for stuff. They paid, you know, and I had what I tell my sponsees, I had pretty girl syndrome. You know what that is. They let you get away with anything. They give you whatever you want, and that's, you stay sick. You stay sick. So anyway, but I knew that I would end up where I shouldn't be. And again, I'm supposed to be careful what I say in this meeting, and I will be careful, but you know what I mean, ladies. I would end up someplace where I shouldn't be. And I had met the man I wanted to marry, and I knew if I kept drinking, I would end up someplace that I couldn't get out of. Has that ever happened to you? Well, you've ended up someplace that you just can't get out of it. So what do? My British friend goes, you lay back and think of Britain. And that's what you do. You know, because you don't really have a choice. You know, and you do, and then, you know, in the old days, they didn't call that the Me Too movement. They called it, oh, well, that's what they called it. So, you know, I didn't want that to happen. And so a girlfriend of mine, I would come to meetings here in Atlanta with her later, but she got thin. This is terrible. She got thin. I'm like, how did she lose the weight? She was a big, tall girl. She had a belly. She said, I stopped drinking. So I'm interested now, you know, because, oh, really? Huh, how'd you do that? And she looked at me and she said, the one thing that got me sober, she said, wouldn't it be nice not to have to think about it? Wouldn't it be nice not to have to plan your hangovers? You know what I'm, you know, plan your hangovers. I had to plan them because I knew they'd be bad. And when I played in a band, you know, they'd be bringing the drinks up at the third, you know, the last set, they'd bring it up, and I would drive home with one hand over one eye. Have you ever done that? You know, you're driving home, and it wasn't far, and, you know, I drove drunk. Of course I did. Like, that's what we do. We drive drunk. So anyway, I thought, wouldn't it be nice not to have to think about it? And it was getting worse. And I had a blackout. But I'm going to tell you all, I was what is known in the industry as a high-bottom drunk because I didn't have a DUI. I didn't get arrested. None of that happened to me. That doesn't mean it shouldn't have happened to me. It just didn't. I got away with it. Okay? I got away with drinking and driving. I got away with all of that. And I was not a blackout drunk from the beginning. So the blackout scared me. And now some of you, you know, I have friends that are like, we use it as time travel. You know, they get, you know, that's a different situation. But I did not use it as time travel. And when I had a blackout, I got really scared. And I said, this can't be normal. So I'm going to tell you, what we're supposed to do is tell you what it was like, what happened, and what we're like now. That's kind of the deal. And I'm actually going to go through the steps if I have time, because I think it's real important to do that. So I went to my first meeting, and I was like, oh, thank God. But I had a moment of clarity right before that, because I had called AA drunk. Have you ever done that? You know, back in the day, you had a phone, and then you call. We didn't have cell phones and everything, so you actually called the AA, and I had done that already, so I knew about AA. My girlfriend had told me about, wouldn't it be nice not to have to think about it, and I went down to this bar with my guitar player where I used to play every Tuesday night in Old Town Alexandria, and I forgot my purse. And so Bobby said, well, I'll buy you something. You know, I said, I'll have a glass of white wine. And he said, I thought you quit drinking. And I went, I'll just have one. Okay. So they bring me a glass of white wine. It's one of those little 6-ounce things. You know those little teeny ones, the little white? And I'm thinking, and I drink it. And guess what I started to do? I started to look around the bar to see who I could hit on to get another drink. Because I couldn't ask Bobby, because he's, I thought you quit drinking, and I'll just have one, and he'd already paid for it. And there was a movie out, I am going to have to, I won't say it, but I've got close, called The Boys in the Band, that was out at that time. And it was this very flaming guy who came out and said, who do you have to, you know what, to get a drink around here? What's the line? You know the line. And all of a sudden I went, I might as well be doing that. I might as well be prostituting myself, because that's how bad I wanted to drink. That was my last drink. My last drink was one drink. Isn't that weird? I mean, that's not usually the way it happens, but that was my, and I went to a meeting the next day, and it was a speaker's meeting, just like this. It was in Maryland, of all places. And I went, oh my God, this is what's wrong with me. Because I'll tell you, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had no idea. I didn't know that this was an illness. I didn't know. And now, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, my God, it's alcoholism. And I'm going to tell you, unlike many people, I wasn't mad about it. I was thrilled to find out what was wrong with me, because I just thought I was crazy, you know, and just acting silly and didn't know. And I couldn't stop it, and I didn't know that there was, like, a the doctor's opinion. I didn't understand the phenomenon of craving. I didn't know what that meant. Everyone in this room knows what the phenomenon of craving means, don't you? Right? Well, guess what? It's not a phenomenon anymore. A phenomenon means they don't know what causes it. Well, my son, he's got 4 years sober, and he was in a rehab in Los Angeles. Now, I never went to rehab, so I didn't know. And apparently there's some chemical thing that happens in your brain when you become an addict that moves the way you look at, you know, alcohol out of desire into survival. And your brain honestly thinks that you need alcohol to survive. It thinks that. Addiction is, that's what it's about. And they can show you pictures of it now. That won't help you get sober. Don't even think that. But it's, but after you're sober, it can be really helpful to know that you get that they know what causes it. That phenomenon of craving is no longer a phenomenon. They know what causes it. But we get it. And our brain tells us, you know, if you had my life, you'd drink too. So if my life's not crazy enough, I'm going to make it crazier. That's what I'm going to do, just so that I can get crazy enough so that you'll go, of course, honey, here, have a cocktail. Right? That's what we do. Our brains do that to us. And I didn't know what that was, so I finally learned about it and began to get an idea of what was happening. And I'm a first nighter. I came in and I never left. Now, some people get mad at me about that. They're like, oh, well, you must not have had it very bad, or, you know, whatever. But I'm going to tell you the story of my mother. My mother was a minister's wife, because when my father left the law, he became a Unitarian minister. So he was a minister, and my mother was 4'10", and she was a minister's wife. And by the time she got sober at age 70, she was up to 18 shots of bourbon a day to get straight. She had to get up in the middle of the night to have a drink because she couldn't get through the whole night. She had the shakes real bad. At age 60, she started trying to get sober. And I was already sober a long time, and I used to drive her to rehab going, better you than me, Ma. I got kids at home. Because by this time, I'd had children. Because I had my children in recovery, by the way. My son's 32, and he's never seen his mother drink. that's a miracle. Just for any of you moms, just know that. But anyway, so I watched my mother get sicker and sicker from age 60 to age 70 when she was an alcoholic who didn't really develop into alcoholism until she was a little bit older. In her mid-40s was when it started to really kick in. And then by 60, my daddy died, and mother just fell off. You know, she just went deep down. And she, you know, thought that a sweet little white Southern lady couldn't be an alcoholic. She just didn't believe she could be one. She thought it was willpower. And she thought if she just was behaved well enough, she could stop drinking. And so 4 rehabs later, she's dying at age 70 in the hospital. So it makes me cry. And this guy who I knew in AA, he's like, Brooks, you're just going to have to accept that your mother's going to die. You know, I mean, this is bad because she has, could have stroked out. You know how you do when you're older, you get neuropathy. Do you all know about neuropathy? It's where it's that your nerves go and your hands and feet. You younger people, it doesn't get better. It gets much worse. But for some reason, my little sister, who's also a minister, my little sister and I were there with Mama, and we're like, Mom, and she's in the hospital. And we're like, Mom, you're not bad. You're just sick. You're not bad. You're just sick. The light went on. My mother picked up her 18-year chip 3 days before she died at 89. And she was helping a lady get a new liver that day. She was helping a lady get a new liver who's in her 50s. You know, she was helping some lady get a new liver. Because that's what AA can do for you, no matter. So it's never too late for the miracle. It's also never too early. I always yell at the young people. Because if you can get sober young, it's a superpower. It's the most incredible thing. I wasn't that. I was 35 when I got sober. Now, I'm going to say one other thing, too. I'm 70 years old. Give it up how good I look. I mean, come on. Right? Right? Do it for vanity, if for no other reason. Okay? I don't care, all the other stuff. Just if you're vain. And what I do now, I get my nails done and my hair and everything, and I call that my bar tab. That's my bar tab. Why? Because I want to look good and I want to feel good. And in the old days, there was this wonderful woman named Dorothy Ayo. She's passed on, so I say her last name in AA. She used to come to meetings always dressed just beautifully. She always looked so good. I'm like, why do you do that? She said, I may be the only big book anybody ever sees. And she was right. I may be the only big book that somebody in this room has ever seen before. I'm a living example of what recovery can give to you if you choose it. It's your choice. One day at a time, it's your choice. So, step one, we come. Step two, you come to. And step three, you come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. And I did not get a God in here for 10 years. Okay? But I kept coming to meetings. And this woman one time, this other friend of, young minister friend of mine, she said, well, if you don't have a God, just make God bigger. That worked for me. If you make God big enough, God can be everything, and then you're fine. You don't have to worry about it. It just stops being a problem. And it stopped being a problem for me, but it took a long time because I came from a group, people that were very scientific and very, my son has a PhD and my sisters, everybody's got doctorates and all that kind of crap. I do have a BA, but that's it. But I'm a musician, so I'm allowed. So anyway, but, everyone was like, and then my brother-in-law kept trying to get me to go to Rational Recovery. Have you all heard of that? It was a thing back in, 20 years ago where, you didn't need a God to get sober. And good luck with all that. And I kept saying, but I'm sober. This is working for me. Why do you want me to do something different? This is where I want to be. So anyway, let's get back to the steps because are y'all with me so far? Okay, so you saw what it was like, what it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And so I got a sponsor. I had my same sponsor for 32 years till she died. I've had local sponsors too. So, I do have a sponsor now. I got a new sponsor to help me with business. Because I'm a musician and I'm an artist. And I do different things. And I'm not good with business, so I had to do a four-step on this, really. I hated it, but I did it, because you're supposed to do as you're told here in AA, and I did it. So anyway, I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, and you were the power greater than myself, the people in the rooms. And in the old days, the little old ladies would take a chair and put it in the middle of the room and say, that's the dead guy. That's the dead guy. And then they would come and hand you $20 and say, and if you're not going to take this seriously, don't waste my time. And I needed that. Because, you know, if you're feeling sorry for yourself, nothing personal, but I don't care how you feel. Isn't that awful to say to people? Oh, no, I don't care how you feel. Because you don't get to drink no matter how you feel. You don't get to do that anymore. So the only question you have to ask yourself after step three is, what am I going to do instead? That's the only question in AA you ever have to ask yourself. If I can't drink, if I can't drug, what am I going to do? Step four. Make us searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Why? How many of you, when you were drinking, paid much attention to how you felt about anything? The reason you drank, one of the reasons we all drink is because we don't have to feel anything. Numb out. You have a black hole right here, right? And it's just, and you need to know that you can take a day off. The problem with AA is you never get a day off again. You have to learn how to love living on the planet. That's tough for a lot of people because, you know, you've had rough lives. My life wasn't all that rough. I'm going to be frank about that. We had issues. You know, my father had issues. My mother was an alcoholic. I mean, it's not like I didn't have stuff. But I'm basically an optimistic person. And I know it's hard for people with depression. I know how hard it is because my daughter has depression. So, you know, I get it if you're having trouble with this. But you don't get to drink anymore. So what are you going to do instead? Do the inventory. And if you can't make yourself do it, just get a piece of paper, write 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and get started. And then you've started it. You've at least doing it. And then step five, share it. I didn't really, you know, have one of those I kill somebody stories. I mean, I had enough, but I didn't have a kill somebody story. A lot of the stuff that happened to me sort of happened to me, which is true for a lot of women. You know what I'm talking about. That, you know, stuff happens to you. And figuring out what is your part in that, how to get your side of the street clean. And that is what steps 6 and 7 are all about. 6 and 7 says separates the men from the boys, but it's also the ladies, you know. It brings you into spiritual adulthood. Why? 6 and 7, it's the most important. We're entirely ready to have God remove all the defects of character. How are you going to do that? First, you got to find out what they are. I didn't know that I, you know, was selfish. I thought I was just noisy. You know, I didn't know. I didn't know how I had hurt people because I never paid any attention. I just barraged through life. Now, other people have, you know, are victims. God bless them. I'm not a victim. I've never been a victim, and I'm not codependent. A lot of people in this room are. Good luck with all that. But, you know, the deal is, I know. It's rough. I mean, I get it. Everybody has their own stuff. That's what I'm saying. We're not all alike in here. We all have alcoholism. And the only cure is, what am I going to do instead? So if you need therapy, if you need help, get it. But first, you need to, what I tell my girls who I sponsor, and I have sponsees that I've had for 30 years. I also have brand new ones, you know, a lot of them drop away. And you can't get anybody sober. My mother, I took her to her first rehab thinking that she was 60, and a rainbow came out, and I thought, oh, look what I did for my mom. She's throwing the big books away and correcting the grammar. That's my mother. Okay, she corrected the grammar in the big books because she was an English teacher. She didn't get sober until she was 70. That was 10 years, 4 rehabs. That was my mom. It, you know, took her a while because she couldn't believe it. So, you know, But what you have to do is 6 and 7, that's what you're supposed to be doing, is that you humbly ask him to remove your shortcomings. But you got to find out what they are first. You know, and a lot of us can't see ourselves very well. It just takes a while. But work with somebody that you like. Work with somebody who you respect. Work with somebody who you feel like that that you want what they have. That's what we used to say in the meeting. If you want what I have, you got to do what I do. It's real simple. You know, if you don't want what I have, then don't pick me. Get somebody who where you see what, you know, you want what they have. And I want what I have today, and what I want today is very different than what I wanted 35 years ago when I was 35 years old. And what I wanted back then was children, and I got them. Took me 4 tries. And I remember one day I was pregnant, and my husband, he was 10 years younger than me, I told you, and he had had a back surgery, and he was in the hospital laid out, and my father had gone in the hospital the same day with cancer. And I get the call that my father was inoperable, you know, and I'm newly sober, my first year. And my husband's in there, so the 2 main people in my life are just like, I go to the nurse's desk, and go, is there a meeting here? Because in the old days, they were in hospitals a lot. They said, yeah, there's a meeting in the basement. It's in Alexandria Hospital. I went down, and there was some kid, he was like 15, he'd lost his brother, and he was sharing. And I kept thinking, well, if he can do it, I can do it. You know, that was all I could think about. So later, this also always makes me cry. I had my son, because my first baby I lost at 13 weeks, so that was real tough because I was older and I didn't know if I'd be able to have children after that. But I ended up, I had to go to bed for 4.5 months. It was like being a hostage. It was a nightmare, but I had my son in Alexandria Hospital, and I went down there and faked that meeting, you know. I went and thanked them. I wouldn't have made it without them. You know, I mean, I went and thanked them. And then when I had my daughter, did the same thing again because, you know, I wouldn't have survived to be a mom at 37. And then I got a birthday card when I was 40 from my mother. Well, it's not so bad being 40. You could be 40 and pregnant. And I was. And yeah, moms can be like that. And so I had my daughter. She's 29, and she's an environmental engineer. And has doing very well. So that's been very cool. So anyway, 8 and 9. Let's just move on. Let's get through the steps, and then I'll just tell you a little bit about what my life's like today, because my life's amazing. Anyway, it's very important that you do step 9 with a sponsor, in my opinion. This is all my opinion, by the way. I speak in declarative sentences, but they're just suggestions, okay? So do this. get a sponsor, because you're going to think you owe amends to people that you don't owe amends to, and you're going to owe amends to people that you don't think you owe amends to. You're going to get confused about that stuff because your ego gets in the way, and that's just normal, and don't worry about it. It's normal, but it is what happens. So if you have somebody to work with on that, but making the list of persons you have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all is really a good thing to do. And really cool amends can happen. I'll just tell you one example for me. There was this girl that I worked with before I had my kids, when we were still drinking. She was a lot younger than me. And she tried to sleep with my husband, pardon the expression, but she did. She tried to get me fired from my job. She was just horrible, you know, all around kind of a pain in the butt person. Years later, my ex-husband ran into her in the Safeway at the grocery store. And I realized I owed her an amends. You know what I owed her amends for? I had not been a very good role model. I was almost 10 years older than she was, and I was acting just as bad as she was. And so I wrote her a letter, and I said, I'm really sorry that I didn't behave better. You know what I mean? And we're friends now. It was kind of cool, because it's those kinds of things where you can patch stuff up that you don't even realize. Because what is your part? Sometimes you don't have a part. And that's even harder, because then you know what you have to do? Acceptance. And acceptance is hard. You know, that you didn't have any part in it. People did bad things to you, and you didn't deserve it, and you had no part in it. And how do you deal with that? Well, you can either carry it or you can let it go. And we call it dropping the rocks. Just drop the rocks. Because the only person it's hurting is you. It's not hurting anybody else. It doesn't hurt anybody else, just you. So anyway, now... Continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 10 is great. Use it. Use it as often. Use it every day. Just take 5 minutes, take 4 deep breaths before you go to sleep and go, what did I do? How was it? And say the good stuff, too. Say the good stuff. So it's real important. And then step 11, solitary prayer meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and power to carry that out. Well, I developed a spiritual program for myself. It is not a traditional Christian program, although, you know, I have some of that from my childhood and left over, whatever, but it's more of a nature-based thing. I am more about being of spirit. That's just me. But whatever God works for you is the God you need to be having a chat with on a daily basis so that you can, you know, check in. And one of the things I learned is sometimes it feels like nobody's listening. But that's okay, because the answers come in God's time, not in my time, or in my higher power's time. And sometimes, and the answers, like, for example, I was signed when I was 19 years old by Bobby Darin, who was a very famous, like, part of the Frank Sinatra and all those guys. And guess what? He died 6 months after I was signed. So I didn't get the career I was supposed to get. I didn't get that big, you know, they wanted to make me Stevie Nicks and all that kind of stuff. I didn't get that. But guess what? I wouldn't have had my kids. I wouldn't have had my kids. My son is an environment. He does robotics for agriculture. Is helping save the planet. My daughter's an environmental engineer. And also, I'm a musician now. I've had 3 top 10 records in my 60s. That's incredible as a folk artist. Why? Because God said it's okay for me to ask for help and to do music now when it's not about being hot and all that, you know, stuff, the young girl stuff. It's about what I have to tell people. I write songs about recovery. It's part of my recovery. And it's been incredible. And I tour in Europe and everything. I mean, and I'm 70. Come on. See, that's the thing AA gives you is a third act. It gives you a gift life. And let me just finish up this with 12. Having had the spiritual awakening as the result, you carry the message. Now, I'm going to say something, the responsibility statement. Do you guys know the responsibility statement? When anyone anywhere reaches out for the hand of AA, I'm always supposed to be there, right? You know that? It's not always your hand. The hand of AA is all of this. So don't forget that, because sometimes, you know, you'll think you're helping when you're really not. Learn to let go, because if there's somebody else could use your help. If somebody's not working out and you're sponsoring and, you know, they're not that interested, let them go. Help somebody else, because that's the thing. There's always plenty of us out there, isn't there? You know, there's a whole lot of us out here. So anyway, that's a little run through of the 12 steps. Was that useful for y'all? Okay. So what's my life like today? I was just starting to tell y'all. First of all, I'm really healthy, which is the benefit of early sobriety when you get sober young. This may not be true for some of you who are getting sober older. It took my mother, but my mother got healthy. She lived to be 89, and she didn't get sober until she was 70. So miracles do happen. I had friends whose livers had regenerated. Miracles happen in here. But if you're kind of youngish, you know, in your 20s and 30s, and you're thinking, well, I can drink a little bit longer. You know, I've got another drunk in me. You may not have another recovery. Because a lot of people get killed in car accidents and stuff, you know. And also, you know, I've had friends who've died on the operating table at 40 of liver and kidney. One of the things that's really hard for me, having been sober this long, is I've been to too many funerals. And I do have trouble with people giving me a load of horse shit, nothing personal, but I get really frustrated with it because I just want to shake you and go, can you hear yourself? You know, you're going to die. And a lot of people have died. One of the reasons I come to NABA and go to the 9:30 meeting almost every day here is there's a lot of recovery there. A lot of people with long-term recovery, and they help me remember why I keep coming back. If you had to take dialysis, you wouldn't care who you were sitting next to. You would get dialysis, right? Meetings are medicine. They actually have done studies 12 minutes in, your endorphins kick in. Did you know that? Your endorphins have kicked in. It took a while. First, you're sort of shaken and you weren't sure. But you're here now. You're with me. Why? Because that's what happens. It's our medicine, and we need to keep taking it the rest of your life. So that's what I do. I go to 5 or 6 meetings a week because I can. When my kids were little, I could only make 1 or 2 meetings a week because, you know, you can't bring toddlers to meetings. It's too much trouble. But you have a sponsor, and you stay connected with the meetings. It really does help. and it'll keep you sober. And all I can say for me is that what AA has done for me is given me what I call my gift life. And it's been 35 years of gifts. I have two beautiful children who've never seen me drink, one of whom was an alcoholic, and who now, but he knew what to do when the time came. And he didn't die. And he was on fentanyl. He didn't die. He got sober. Because he knew where to go. He knew what to do. That had nothing to do with me. When he came to me and said he was going in, I said, I can't help you. I said, I'm going to go help these women over here. I'm going to go help her. Because you can't 12-step your own family. I mean, it's just too hard. And then, you know, you guys have to help each other. But I can help these women. I can. I can help you, and you can help me by keeping it, you know, we stay sober. And he's managed to stay sober, which is the biggest miracle of my life. And my mother and I used to go to meetings together. She died a few years ago. And I just was up at her meeting, one of her meetings. I picked up my chip up there at one of her meetings, of people that she helped. Because she was in for 18 years, and she, you know, would come in, and she was shorter than me. And just, you know, and would tell her story. And people would just, and she helped a lot of folk. So that's the kind of thing that I want to say. It's a family disease. It will kill you if you let it. But you can, we do recover. We do recover. It doesn't say we might recover. It doesn't say we kind of recover. It says we do recover. If, there's only one caveat. If you have the capacity to be honest. That's it. How it works. We do recover if we have the capacity to be honest. And that's really about being honest with yourself. Quit pretending that you've got this. Because you don't. Nobody does. And that's okay. Just be willing to say, try that with diarrhea and see how it works. Right? You don't, you know, and if you, and also, in the old days, if you catch cancer early, everybody's so happy. So the cancer patient, the heart patient, and the alcoholic all have incurable diseases. The cancer patient, they say, we're going to have to give you chemo or, you know, surgery. They go, where do I start? The heart patient, we have to cut you open, you know, and you get a vein out of your leg and all this. And they go, where do I start? Alcoholic. You have to go to these meetings. Alcoholic goes, how many meetings did you say I had to go to? That's what it's like. So I like to laugh in AA. We are not a glum lot. I am, you know, happy, joyous, and free. And what I want to do, I've recommitted to AA on my 70th birthday and my 35th anniversary. And because of my mother, because she didn't even get sober till she was 70. So I'm recommitting to AA to be of service. Which is why I said I would speak here tonight, because I'm recommitting to being of service, because it does work if you work it. And it'll work you even if you don't know, so that's also true. But give yourself a chance to do as you're told, because that was the hardest thing for me. I don't like anybody telling me what to do. But I finally did as I was told. And I'll just tell you one more thing for health. I was pre-diabetic. And I went to the doctor, and they said, well, we're sending you to a nutritionist, and you're going to do some things. And so I did it, and they said, wow, your numbers are normal now. That's incredible. What did you do? And I said, I did what you told me to do. And they burst out laughing. They were like, nobody does what we tell them to do. So that's the thing about being honest. Be honest with yourself. And if you ask your higher power to, you know, relieve you of the bondage of self, that you may do as well, life gets a lot easier. So I want to thank y'all for asking me to speak, and I wanted to just tell y'all that I love every single one of you, because you're amazing. It's been really fun talking with y'all. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, that was great. Okay, we have asked a friend to come give up the chips. Deanna.
Deanna, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. We offer the white chips for a new way of life. Okay. and we offer the silver chip for 30 days, the gold for 60, the red for 9 months. Okay, 6 months. Okay. Green one for you. For 1 year? Or multiples?
This is my big brother, Frank W. And Frank is a fixture in the NABBA Club. His picture's up in the lobby 4 times. It's not a wanted poster. He was a frightening guy. When I first got here, I would carry like a big book and flexions. And
carried 6 books.
6 books. I mean, I was like, you know, freshman at NABBA. I was down in the standing in line at the cafeteria downstairs. He walks up to me. My books are stacked up on the tray. And he said, you know, those books will work a lot better for you if you read them. And that was the first thing he'd ever said to me. I was offended. But I talked to my sponsor, Tim, and he explained that maybe he had a point. So, anyway, thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Made a big difference in my life.
I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And as the lady alluded to, if you look at the third page in the big book, it says how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. I did this by failing at everything I tried, failing at all the suggestions my sponsors gave me. And there weren't really suggestions back then. They just told you what to do.
Yep.
They didn't say, oh, you know, you really should try this. And nobody said that. They said either do this or get the fuck on. And maybe they didn't do it at NABBA, but they do it at Biscayne. So finally, after everything I wanted to do, or I thought would you know, be helpful, didn't work, I took their suggestion. And I had to admit that, you know, it worked. I kept trying to keep in different company. I started doing things that I'm supposed to do. And I don't fall into that BS about regretting my past. I don't regret my past. I've got 33 years today of a better past. So, if you've got a week or two or 3 days, you've already got a better past than what you came here with.
Right.
Don't forget what keeps you sober. And that's action. Action keeps you sober. Inaction keeps you depressed. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
And we offer the white chip one more time.
Why?
Because it's the most important one. Congratulations.
Hi, thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Maybe young and frightened and trying not to show it. Hear the voices shouting and only feel confused. It's hard to tell what truth is and where you should be going. You look around for guidance and wind up feeling used. You can tend the nest. You can mend the fences. You can do your part and help those who are defenseless. Work behind the scenes, small as it may be, build a way to carry us from sea to shining sea. Maybe old and weary and full of pain and strife. You may be past caring about someone else's plight. Wanna look the other way, and maybe that's the cause. bones can't take the punishment of marching for a cause. You can tend the nest, you can mend the fences, you can do your part and help those who are defenseless. Work behind the scenes, small as it may be, build a wave to carry us from sea to shining sea. From